Chapter 7. Zuckerberg should be in jail. Donald Trump's 2016 victory was a shock to much of the country, but Silicon Valley took it especially hard. The progressive bastion of San Francisco had turned tech companies from libertarian idealists into liberal crusaders. The industry as a whole felt complicit in Donald Trump's rise and was intent on doing everything in its power to suppress his voice and those of his supporters. Not long after the 2016 election, Google held a company-wide meeting. "As an immigrant and a refugee, I certainly find this election deeply offensive, and I know many of you do too," Google founder Sergey Brin told his employees in a meeting, a video of which was leaked to Breitbart News. Kent Walker, Google's senior vice president for global affairs, said Trump's win was a result of xenophobia, hatred, and a desire for answers that may or may not be there. Google's CFO, Ruth Porat, started crying. "Given the awesome power Silicon Valley wields in shaping American discourse, it was unlikely it was just going to accept the will of voters. From the beginning, the tech overlords were plotting how to strike back." In the meeting, Brin suggested that Jigsaw, a project Google had developed to combat Islamic terror propaganda, could be used to shape the opinions of Trump voters. By the time Trump was inaugurated, a former Google engineer had told Breitbart reporter Alam Bokhari that activists within the company had formed a working group to brainstorm ways to use Google's resources to undermine the Trump administration. Another Google engineer wanted to sabotage Trump's phone, which ran on Google's Android operating system, as well as ban the Gmail accounts of senior Trump administration officials. An employee in Google's advertising department personally referred purchasers of Google ads to the website of Sleeping Giants, an activist group that encourages boycotts of conservative news outlets. It wasn't any better over at Facebook, where some employees literally took a week off to grieve. Managers sent out wistful emails pontificating about how the election was a devastating setback for women and minorities, and that we should keep their struggle at the forefront of our minds, a Facebook employee told Bokhari, author of #deleted, Big Tech's Battle to Erase the Trump Movement and Steal the Election. There were numerous cases of employees sending anti-Trump propaganda, invitations to protests, and solicitations for progressive charities straight to their work mailing lists. Soon after the election, BuzzFeed was reporting, "Facebook employees have formed an unofficial task force to question the role their company played in promoting fake news in the lead-up to Donald Trump's victory in the U.S. election last week." The group was operating in open defiance of CEO Mark Zuckerberg, who said the idea that Facebook had unfairly tilted the election in Trump's favor was crazy. Zuckerberg had already faced criticism earlier, in May 2016, when Gizmodo reported Facebook workers routinely suppressed news stories of interest to conservative readers from the social network's influential trending news section, according to a former journalist who worked on the project. By December 2016, Zuckerberg had caved. Facebook adopted a new policy of trying to combat the alleged fake news that troubled Facebook's left-wing employees. The tech giant would start paying media outlets to fact-check news on the site. With media revenue steadily declining, in no small part because Facebook had radically disrupted the traditional journalistic business models, once reputable news organizations signed up to participate in the fact-checking program. Media outlets that were supposed to be objectively covering Facebook were now on Facebook's payroll, given the power to determine all the news that was fit to print. Whether or not the tech companies wanted to admit it, much of Silicon Valley's anger over Trump's victory was about their inability to control American opinion. In the past two elections, the tech industry had loudly and publicly taken credit for helping Obama's two victorious campaigns. For years, the dreamers that built Silicon Valley had prided themselves on the potential of the internet to become a digital libertarian oasis that offered people a way of opting out of the institutions that had historically sought to control what they thought and did. This was always a bit of a pipe dream, but when a Twitter executive famously referred to the social media platform as the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party in 2012, Americans still largely believed the internet was a force for good. But Silicon Valley's Orwellian reaction to 2016 proved once and for all that the visionaries at America's tech companies were oppressors, not liberators. In 2018, a whistleblower at Google sent Boccari another internal document. The document was titled The Good Censor, and it summed up Google's role in mediating America's discourse this way. Free speech has become a social, economic, and political weapon. In 2008, Obama ran the first real online campaign, which wasn't just important as a matter of innovation. It was at least as important as a cultural signifier. Obama was all over YouTube, Facebook, and the other still nascent social networks. Meanwhile, his campaign ran ads attacking his septuagenarian opponent for not knowing how to use a computer or his cell phone. It wasn't until Obama's re-election in 2012 that the press became obsessed with stories on the impact of social media and new technologies on political campaigns. Even for a politician used to a tsunami of adoring press, the coverage on his tech-savvy campaign was a high watermark. A not atypical Guardian headline in 2012 read, "Obama, Facebook, and the Power of Friendship, the 2012 Data Election." 4 years later, The Guardian declared, "2016, the year Facebook became the bad guy." Facebook had grown exponentially since Obama's first election in 2008. And in 2012, The Guardian was eager to report that a unified computer database that gathers and refines information on millions of potential voters is at the forefront of campaign technology and could be the key to an Obama win. The Obama campaign opened a Silicon Valley field office to tap into all the tech expertise that was rushing to help his campaign. Carol Davidson, the analytics director for Obama's campaign, would later admit that the campaign had access to all of Facebook's data, saying, "Facebook allowed us to do things they wouldn't have allowed someone else to do because they were on our side." For years, programmers and video game designers had been finding creative ways to exploit peer pressure and dopamine spikes to get people to open their wallets. Getting them to the voting booth seemed like a comparatively easy task. Facebook data was just the starting point. In 2012, Sasha Isenberg wrote The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, which discusses in detail cutting-edge persuasion experiments, innovative ways to mobilize voters, and statistical models predicting the behavior of every voter in the country. It soon became clear that campaigns were engaged in much more concerning behavior than merely adapting to the smartphone era. The Obama campaign released an app to the public to help Obama volunteers canvass their neighborhoods. The app contained detailed and intimate information about people's political tendencies, such as partisan affiliation. That an anonymous volunteer could download the app just to be encouraged to knock on his neighbor's doors and instantly record his feelings about the president into an electronic database didn't seem to be cause for concern. The New York Times called the app the science fiction dream of political operatives and said the campaign is betting that the technology will vastly expand the number of supporters who will beat the pavement for Mr. Obama. Republicans had no choice but to get good at using technology and exploiting social media networks. And the Trump campaign did just that, which caused people to lose their minds. In 2012, the Obama campaign sucked up all the data on Facebook and was greeted with a chorus of hosannas, celebrating tech-savvy electioneering. In 2016, when the Trump campaign did the exact same thing, the media started yelling that the sky was falling. Throw in the fact that the Russians bought a few $100,000 worth of election ads on Facebook, and all of a sudden social media was to blame for the election of Donald Trump to the nation's highest office. For Trump's entire presidency, the hysteria never died down. In March 2020, The Atlantic's McKay Coppins published an 8,000-word deep dive into the president's 2020 digital campaign operation titled The Billion-Dollar Disinformation Campaign to Re-elect the President. The tone of Coppins' article was alarmist, and lots of liberal voters agreed with it. Among them was former President Obama. Obama, who felt no compunction about urging Americans to interrogate their neighbors about their political views and record their responses on his campaign's app, tweeted out a link to Coppins' article, accompanied by a typically grandiose and hypocritical judgment of the Trump campaign. Even if the methods are new, sowing the seeds of doubt, division, and discord to turn Americans against each other is an old trick. If there were any technological tricks in the Trump years, it was abundantly obvious that they were being pulled on the president and his voters. In January 2018, Project Veritas, a journalism outlet that specializes in undercover investigations, released a video of a former content review agent at Twitter. The agent admitted that the platform was biased against conservatives, while Twitter employees reviewing questionable content let a lot of the left-leaning or liberal stuff go through unchecked. Veritas's investigation also featured a former software engineer at Twitter who admitted that the company shadow banned users, a term for when social media companies employ algorithms to decrease the visibility of certain users without telling them. Numerous prominent conservatives had seen sudden decreases in engagement on social media and had long suspected that this was happening. In January 2020, Twitter updated its terms of service to formally assert the right to limit distribution or visibility of any content on the service. And Twitter was hardly an outlier. In December 2018, Google CEO Sundar Pichai testified under oath before Congress that the company doesn't manually intervene in search results. The next month, a Google employee leaked internal discussions to Breitbart, showing that the company did, in fact, interfere with search results. Google-owned YouTube, the world's second most popular search engine after Google itself, had a blacklist, Google's term, related to a number of political topics. If you searched YouTube for abortion, Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters, gun control activist David Hogg, or other political topics, Google was rigging the results. But that was just the tip of the iceberg. We have tons of white and black lists that humans manually curate, said one Google employee. Hopefully this isn't surprising or particularly controversial. Another employee noted that the YouTube intervention on abortion search results happened shortly after left-wing publication Slate asked Google to comment on the prominence of pro-life videos on the platform. Google also appears to have intentionally reduced the search engine rankings and visibility of conservative media. A September 2020 report in Real Clear Politics by Maxim Lott sifted through the data of the consulting firm Systrix, which tracks data related to search engine optimization. The data clearly show that starting in 2017, conservative news sites including Breitbart, The Daily Caller, and The Federalist have seen their Google search listings dramatically reduced, and Google was making it absurdly difficult to find specific information on conservative outlets. Googling the name Breitbart still pulls up the website, but it is nearly eliminated from any searches that don't explicitly name it. For example, Googling the names of Breitbart's reporters sometimes forces users to click through page after page of less relevant results before hitting a Breitbart link. In the case of Joel Pollack, the first Breitbart link appears on the bottom of page 7 of Google search results. In comparison, a search on the small Google competitor DuckDuckGo returns multiple links to Pollack's Breitbart work on the first page. The decision to blackball conservative websites was almost certainly intentional. In 2018, the Daily Caller obtained more leaked internal communications showing that Google workers had debated burying conservative news sites. An employee described Breitbart and the Daily Caller specifically as opinion blogs that should not be elevated next to corporate media in search results, even though both websites do vital reporting and regularly break major political news. While major corporate media outlets have become hyper-partisan and routinely push fake news. It's undeniable Google is rigging results on politically sensitive topics, and that the results of this are politically disadvantageous to conservatives. The effect of this on elections appears to be far more significant than most realize. Starting in 2012, psychologist Robert Epstein, the former editor-in-chief of Psychology Today, conducted a series of experiments to ascertain the degree to which biased search engine results can shape political opinion. Most people wrongly view search engine results as the product of mechanical neutrality, merely the ranking and ordering of results, and are easily influenced by them. Epstein, a politically liberal Harvard PhD, would later report that during 2016, all 10 positions on the first page of Google search results in both blue states and red states were biased toward Hillary Clinton. Based on conclusions from his previous experiments, Epstein estimated that Google alone may have swayed 2.6 million Americans to vote for Hillary Clinton. In 2019, Epstein would tell the Senate Judiciary Committee that search engine manipulation is one of the most powerful forms of influence ever discovered in the behavioral sciences. In 2020, Epstein monitored Google results using over 700 volunteers in three swing states and concluded Google search results were strongly biased in favor of liberals and Democrats. This was not true on Bing or Yahoo. The bottom line at the moment is that these manipulations, the ones that we've so far quantified, could easily have shifted at least 6 million votes in just one direction. Further, Epstein observed what he claimed was overt manipulation by Google. We also found what seems to be a smoking gun. That is, we found a period of days when the vote reminder on Google's homepage was being sent only to liberals. Not one of our conservative field agents received a vote reminder during those days, he said. But the outcomes of social science experiments are debatable, and the effects of bias are difficult to measure. The overt targeting of Trump supporters across the tech and social media landscape, however, is undeniable. In July 2020, Reddit banned R the Donald, a popular online community for Trump supporters that had more than 790,000 subscribers. It was a raucous and edgy community, but that hardly made it unique on a site such as Reddit, which bills itself as the best place online to have truly authentic conversations. The ban was more likely a consequence of the personal and political animosity by Reddit's CEO Steve Huffman. In 2016, shortly after Trump's election, Huffman was so angered that he used his database privileges to edit comments from R the Donald members making fun of him. When evidence surfaced showing what he'd done, Huffman issued an apology. After 2016, numerous other sites were scrubbed from the web, hidden from Google searches, banned from social media, or otherwise deplatformed. Popular conservative social media accounts were banned for their political views, cutting them off from access to their users. Carpe Donctum, the internet handle for a prominent pro-Trump meme maker with 270,000 followers, was kicked off Twitter for copyright violations in June 2020. For anyone who spent any time on Twitter, where millions of memes using pre-existing images are floating around constantly, it was an absurd excuse. Just over a year after Carpe Donctum was booted from Twitter, the New York Supreme Court tossed the copyright complaint Twitter had specifically cited in its decision for the ban. It's more likely that meme makers such as Carpe Donctum were so effective at disseminating a pro-Trump message that biased social media platforms found them threatening and moved to shut them down. On May 15, 2020, the month before Carpe Donctum's ban, Trump had tweeted, "Thank you to all of my great keyboard warriors. You are better and far more brilliant than anyone on Madison Avenue. Ad agencies. There is nobody like you." The witch hunts didn't just take place online. You could get no more dramatic illustration of how intolerant and hostile Silicon Valley was to Trump supporters than the story of Palmer Luckey, a true tech visionary who brought virtual reality to the masses as the founder of Oculus VR, the company that created the popular Oculus Rift goggles. In 2014, Facebook bought Oculus for $3 billion and brought Luckey on board to work at the company. In September 2016, it was revealed that Luckey had donated $10,000 to a pro-Trump group. The company went into crisis mode and pressured Luckey to sign a letter stating that he would be voting for the Libertarian Party candidate, Gary Johnson. Luckey never signed the letter and left Facebook in March 2017. The next year, Senator Ted Cruz asked Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg in a Senate hearing why Luckey was fired. Zuckerberg assured the senator that it was not because of a political view. After he left, Luckey threatened to sue Facebook and negotiated an astounding settlement of $100 million over his termination, which seems like an implausible amount if he didn't have an ironclad case for wrongful termination. As the 2020 election drew near, social media companies, driven by internal pressure from employees as well as external pressure from liberal activists, started targeting Trump directly. It seemed an inevitable development, the logical conclusion of censorship that had been mounting since 2016. Despite clear signs that censorship was coming, Republicans hadn't taken strong enough action to deter the tech giants. They would pay the price for their inaction in November. It began on May 26th, when Trump fired off two tweets about the Democrats' push for widespread use of mail-in balloting. "There is no way, zero, that mail-in ballots will be anything less than substantially fraudulent. Mailboxes will be robbed, ballots will be forged, and even illegally printed out and fraudulently signed. The governor of California is sending ballots to millions of people. Anyone living in the state, no matter who they are or how they got there, will get one. That will be followed up with professionals telling all of these people, many of whom have never even thought of voting before, how and for whom to vote. This will be a rigged election. No way." In what would become a standard practice, Twitter quickly appended both tweets with an exclamation point, followed by a link where users of the site could get the facts about mail-in ballots. That link led to a short statement from Twitter saying that Trump makes unsubstantiated claim that mail-in ballots will lead to voter fraud, with a short summary of facts about mail-in voting. Twitter's contention was downright false. Trump's claims were backed by hard evidence and expert opinion. As discussed throughout this book, mail-in ballots are known to be more susceptible to fraud. For decades, experts of differing political persuasions had expressed grave concerns about mail-in voting. While Trump may not have cited their studies in a footnote, he was hardly making a reckless claim. It just so happened that Trump's opinion now clashed with the Democratic Party line. Further, the facts about mail-in voting that Twitter presented as an alternative to Trump's tweet were convoluted, misleading, and made a complete hash of the issue. An article in Wired magazine, which otherwise applauded Twitter for censoring the president, lamented, "It's remarkable that after having years to prepare for the portentous moment of calling out a false Trump tweet, Twitter couldn't even bulletproof its own fact check." The censors would strike again just days later, on May 29th. As riots consumed Minneapolis following the death of George Floyd, Trump sent two tweets. "I can't stand back and watch this happen to a great American city, Minneapolis. A total lack of leadership. Either the very weak radical left mayor, Jacob Frey, get his act together and bring the city under control, or I will send in the National Guard and get the job done right. These thugs are dishonoring the memory of George Floyd, and I won't let it happen. Just spoke to Governor Tim Walz and told him that the military is with him all the way. Any difficulty and we will assume control. But when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Thank you." Within minutes, Twitter hid Trump's second tweet and replaced it with a message that read, "This tweet violated the Twitter rules about glorifying violence. However, Twitter has determined that it may be in the public's interest for the tweet to remain accessible." Users could see the tweet, but not retweet it, quote tweet it, or respond to it. The White House Twitter account soon fired back. Twitter, in an email to the White House moments ago, admitted that the very tweet they are censoring does not violate any Twitter rules. So why are they still censoring it? The tweet included a photo of the letter which said, "We have investigated the reported content and could not identify any violations of the Twitter rules. Accordingly, we have not taken any action at this time." The baseless censorship would continue unabated from there on out. Another few days later, Twitter completely blocked another Trump tweet that read, "There will never be an autonomous zone in Washington, D.C. as long as I'm your president. If they try, they will be met with serious force." Twitter's justification for censoring the president was that the tweet violated a site policy about the presence of a threat of harm against an identifiable group. Since there was no autonomous zone in Washington, who was the identifiable group Trump was threatening? And since when was promising to uphold the law against criminals and anarchists threatening? If state-sanctioned force is not justified against violent anarchists, when does Twitter think it is justified? The president is, after all, the nation's chief law enforcement officer. The dam had broken. For the rest of the election, Twitter would regularly block or otherwise censor the president's tweets. The censorship exposed egregious double standards. At a hearing before the Israeli Knesset in July, a representative of Twitter was asked why the company was censoring Trump, but had done nothing about Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei, who had repeatedly called for the destruction of Israel and Jewish genocide. Just over a week before Trump's censored tweet about looting, Khamenei had tweeted, "The only remedy until the removal of the Zionist regime is firm armed resistance," and Twitter did nothing. The response from Twitter to the Knesset was disingenuous, to put it mildly. Khamenei got a free pass because comments on political issues of the day or foreign policy saber-rattling on economic or military issues are generally not in violation of our Twitter rules. Again, the more likely explanation is that Twitter, much like the executives at all the other tech companies, despised Trump and his politics. Twitter's executive in charge of site integrity, who is largely responsible for devising and implementing the platform's new fact-checking policies, is a man with thin journalistic credentials named Yoel Roth. Roth has used his own Twitter account to express his vitriolic and anti-Trump political opinions. "I'm just saying we fly over those states that voted for a racist tangerine for a reason," he tweeted. In another tweet, he declared there were actual Nazis in the White House. The latter accusation merited its own fact check. But either way, Roth's bias against Trump, never mind ordinary conservative users of Twitter, is obvious. No one has any reason to expect Twitter executives are capable of being judicious and fair when determining what viewpoints are permissible in a political debate. Facebook was not to be outdone by Twitter's heavy-handed censorship. Unlike Twitter, which took it upon itself to engage in censorship directly, Facebook was eager to maintain the veneer of neutrality. As a result, it outsourced its fact-checking to other media organizations. Facebook compensated these organizations well, thus further extending its influence over the media landscape. But the power was more important than the money. Legacy media outlets were all too eager to silence conservative news sources that challenged their reporting or called their standards into question. Censorship was now a cornerstone of liberal political orthodoxy. On September 27th, Project Veritas released footage purporting to expose an illegal vote brokering scheme. The story centered on Minneapolis's Somali immigrant community in the controversial Democratic representative Ilhan Omar's congressional district. In the videos Project Veritas recorded, a Somali man explains how men go door to door with absentee ballot forms, telling voters, "This year you will vote for Ilhan. When we sign the voting document and they fill it out is when they give us the money." While Project Veritas's report wasn't documented proof of voter fraud, it was newsworthy and contained enough details to demand further reporting. Immigrant communities were often sources of voter fraud. In 2000, an investigative report in the Wall Street Journal detailed fraud problems with mail-in ballots in Hispanic communities that exploited elderly immigrants who often didn't speak English. Similarly, the fraud that took place in Paterson, New Jersey, earlier that year, appeared to exploit the city's immigrant communities. But not only did news outlets refuse to follow up on the Veritas report, they tried to suppress it. Less than 48 hours after the release of the Veritas video, the New York Times coverage of the report began with this sentence: "A deceptive video released on Sunday by the conservative activist James O'Keefe, which claimed through unidentified sources and with no verifiable evidence that Representative Ilhan Omar's campaign had collected ballots illegally, was probably part of a coordinated disinformation effort, according to researchers at Stanford University." The headline was even more declarative. "Project Veritas video was a coordinated disinformation campaign," researchers say. The article offered no proof that Project Veritas's report was a disinformation campaign. The Times's entire report was premised on speculation. Since Project Veritas's report came out soon after a big New York Times report on President Trump's leaked tax returns, the Times hubristically assumed the voter fraud report was released for the sole purpose of stealing the limelight from its own reporting. To lend its untethered explanation the air of legitimacy, the Times quoted academic experts who asserted that the timing seemed suspicious. The Times went on to publish a number of follow-up articles similarly dismissive of the Veritas report, calling it deceptive, disinformation, and false. USA Today, one of Facebook's official fact-checking partners, cited the Times's reporting when it published an article headlined, "Fact Check: No Proof of Alleged Voter Fraud Scheme or Connection to Representative Ilhan Omar." Naturally, Project Veritas's report was soon censored by Facebook. Project Veritas defends the integrity of its report to this day. It has sued the New York Times for defamation. In March 2021, a New York State Supreme Court judge rebuked the Times for pioneering a novel defense against libel in the case. The paper argued that it hadn't libeled Project Veritas, since New York Times reporters are entitled to assert opinions in news stories without labeling or distinguishing opinion from fact. Veritas contends that NYT's own ethical policies, which NYT publishes on its website, prohibit news reporters from injecting their subjective opinions into news stories published by NYT, and thus a reasonable reader would expect a news reporter's statements to be assertions of fact and not opinion, wrote Judge Charles D. Wood. As of this writing, the outcome of Project Veritas's libel suit is unresolved. The Veritas report was just one piece of explosive news that the media and big tech censored before the election. It is an instructive example in how different groups conspired to throw the game to Joe Biden. Facebook once touted its ability to shut off 80% of the internet traffic to any link it deems misleading. When deciding whom to censor, Facebook relied on media fact checkers who consider themselves the opposition party. Biased journalists were given the power to scrub their rivals from the internet, thanks more to the legacy of their places of employment than their own work. This process of erroneous or slanted liberal media reports informing Facebook fact checks played out through Trump's entire presidency and re-election effort. It suppressed dozens of news stories in the public interest and helped get Biden over the finish line. While tech platforms censored and banned conservative media outlets, their founders were eager to insert themselves more directly into the democratic process. The power to shape public opinion was not enough. They wanted the power to determine election outcomes. And to an alarming degree, Democrats achieved control over elections in 2020. What made 2020 different was that for the first time ever, the groups that supported Democrats were allowed, on a widespread basis, to cross that bright red line that separates government officials who administer an election from political operatives. Unelected liberal activists were allowed to embed in government offices and actually take over election administration duties in crucial battleground states. They were given vast amounts of voter information and even put in charge of designing, distributing, and collecting ballots. While there are always activist groups on both the right and the left fighting over candidates and election rules, the battles over electioneering in the 2020 election were substantially different. It was as if the Dallas Cowboys were allowed to hire and train their own family members to serve as referees, and then got angry the losing team didn't publicly accept a narrow loss with several controversial calls. In 2020, liberal organizations, corporate interests, and a tech billionaire spent hundreds of millions of dollars getting access to the levers of government power in key states with the goal of ousting Donald Trump. This privatization of election administration tainted the entire election. There was no concern about this outrageous arrangement from the media and other watchdogs. Instead, they dishonestly spun it as a triumph of voting rights and clean elections. Months after the 2020 presidential election, Time magazine published its triumphant story of how the election was won by a well-funded cabal of powerful people, ranging across industries and ideologies, working together behind the scenes to influence perceptions, change rules and laws, steer media coverage, and control the flow of information. They were not rigging the election, they were fortifying it. The article was written by Molly Ball, a journalist who had recently published a biography of Democratic Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi that the Wall Street Journal's Barton Swaim described as one of the most cloyingly adulatory paeans to a living politician I've ever read. He added, "If I ever write anything so mindlessly celebratory about any elected official, living or dead, liberal or conservative, I hope the editor of these pages will have the decency to fire me and suggest a career in advertising or political consultancy." The book was uncomfortably friendly to the powerful Democrat and confirmed that Ball had close ties to Democratic leaders. Of all people, she was in a position to know the story of what happened in 2020. In her piece, Ball told a cheerful story about a conspiracy unfolding behind the scenes, the result of an informal alliance between left-wing activists and business titans. She purported to tell the inside story of the conspiracy to save the 2020 election. Of course, the leaders of the Democratic Party weren't trying to save the election. They were out to win it, by hook or by crook, no matter Ball's gauzy reframing. And the same tech oligarchs whose companies silenced Donald Trump and his allies were bankrolling the operation. Former Obama White House Associate Counsel Ian Bassin told Ball, "It's massively important for the country to understand that it didn't happen accidentally. The system didn't work magically. Democracy is not self-executing." It would be more accurate to say that Bassin wasn't ultimately concerned about democracy in a larger sense. These activists were much more concerned about enabling the Democratic Party's push to expand mail-in voting and focus its get-out-the-vote operation on mail-in voting. If it could get local and state governments to assist in that partisan effort, Trump would be defeated. Bassin's group, Protect Democracy, which Ball described as nonpartisan, is an unabashedly leftist group. It sued President Trump's 2016 campaign for alleged collusion with Russia, the conspiracy theory that the Democratic National Committee and Clinton campaign had secretly launched and laundered through the media and bureaucracy to affect the previous elections. Bassin's group sued Wisconsin in 2020 to oppose its ballot security laws. Ball wrote of the group of Democratic leaders, "Their work touched every aspect of the election. They got states to change voting systems and laws and helped secure hundreds of millions in public and private funding. They fended off voter suppression lawsuits, recruited armies of poll workers, and got millions of people to vote by mail for the first time. They successfully pressured social media companies to take a harder line against disinformation and used data-driven strategies to fight viral smears. They executed national public awareness campaigns that helped Americans understand how the vote count would unfold over days or weeks, preventing Trump's conspiracy theories and false claims of victory from getting more traction. After Election Day, they monitored every pressure point to ensure that Trump could not overturn the result." In Ball's telling, the effort to control the election began in 2019 when Mike Podhorzer, a senior advisor to the president of the AFL-CIO, a Democratic special interest group, began to worry Trump would win. Podhorzer co-chairs Catalyst, a firm that provides data, software, and analytics for left progressive groups and candidates. That group is closely aligned with Democracy Alliance, a major liberal donor clearinghouse that helps distribute hundreds of millions of dollars every year to a variety of liberal causes. A coalition of resistance groups called the Fight Back Table began to plan scenarios about how to secure victory for Democrats. They gathered liberal activists across the country into something called the Democracy Defense Coalition to further plan and strategize. Podhorzer put together a network that included the labor movement, the institutional left, like Planned Parenthood and Greenpeace, resistance groups like Indivisible and Move On, progressive data geeks and strategists, representatives of donors and foundations, state-level grassroots organizers, racial justice activists, and others. Tellingly, Ball reported that the BLM riots were a key part of their effort to impact the election, as the leaders of these groups drew energy from the summer's racial justice protests, many of whose leaders were a key part of the Liberal Alliance. In April 2020, Podhorzer began hosting hours-long Zoom sessions every week to coordinate the effort to secure the 2020 election for Biden. The meetings became the galactic center for a constellation of operatives across the left who shared overlapping goals but didn't usually work in concert, Ball wrote. The first task was overhauling America's balky election infrastructure in the middle of a pandemic. Podhorzer's effort was the operational complement to Democratic lawyer Mark Elias's structural reforms. He wanted to raise an army of progressive activists to administer the election at the ground level. But even progressive armies need money. Podhorser needed to hire staff to work mail-in balloting and get out the vote operations, cornerstones of the Democratic Party's plan for 2020. He needed to buy scanners and other equipment to process mail-in ballots. Podhorser and other activists lobbied the federal government to pay for the parts of Democrats' mail-in ballot strategy that state and local governments themselves could do, claiming it was necessary because of the coronavirus. Congress allocated hundreds of millions of dollars, but the progressive activists needed much more to accomplish their vision. That's when private philanthropy stepped into the breach, according to Time. Big Democratic donors funded a dizzying array of liberal nonprofit groups to assist the Democratic effort to win in 2020. These groups may have technically been nonpartisan, but they all had strong, nearly exclusive ties to the Democratic Party. The Voter Participation Center, for example, helped the effort by running focus groups, sending out ballot applications to millions of people, and running ads encouraging the Get Out the Vote operation. All the work we have done for 17 years was built for this moment of bringing democracy to people's doorsteps, Time quoted Tom Lopak, the center's CEO, as saying. Lopak was a longtime Democratic activist and the former executive director of the Committee for a Democratic Majority. The Voter Participation Center itself has always been run by Democrats, who focused on registering groups that lean Democratic. Even the liberal Washington Post admitted in 2020 that the group, while technically nonpartisan, was aligned with efforts to defeat the president. Even though the group was officially nonpartisan for tax purposes, there was no secret that the goal of all its efforts was to generate new votes for Democrats, wrote Sasha Isenberg in the Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. Ball also highlighted All Voting is Local, a left-leaning get-out-the-vote operation. Hannah Freed, the organization's national campaign director, worked on Obama's re-election campaign and was a deputy general counsel on the 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign. That group focused its 2020 efforts not nationwide, but on the same states Democrats had identified as their primary targets: Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin. Ball also highlighted the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, another group that is technically nonpartisan but is, in practice, fiercely liberal. The center was named for former Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, known as the father of judicial activism, and has a history of supporting far-left judicial activism. It would help groups file lawsuits when needed. Time highlighted other groups fortifying the election, all affiliated with the left and boasting strong ties to the Democratic Party. The Voting Rights Lab's co-founders are affiliated with Every Town for Gun Safety, an anti-gun rights organization, and NARO Pro-Choice America, two groups that are key members of the Democratic coalition. Into Action, which spreads state-specific memes about mail-in balloting, is run by former Obama administration official Yossi Sargent. The National Vote at Home Institute partners with progressive and leftist organizations, including the Democracy Fund, Common Cause, nonprofit Vote, and Rock the Vote. Steven Silberstein, a mega donor in Democracy Alliance, is on the board. Dozens of these groups were involved with the effort to secure the election for Democrats by pushing mail-in balloting. And the plan worked. Nearly half of voters voted by mail, and another quarter voted early. It was, Ball wrote, practically a revolution in how people vote. The money for the effort was funneled by billionaires through dark money groups. One billionaire in particular took a prominent and public role in the effort, and it was his money that enabled these far-left groups to embed within the voting system itself. That billionaire was Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. At Facebook, we took our responsibility to protect the integrity of this election very seriously. We've built sophisticated systems to protect against election interference, CEO Mark Zuckerberg told ABC News shortly after the election. He highlighted his censorship work, which he described as a fight against misinformation. Zuckerberg didn't just help Democrats by censoring their political opponents. He directly funded liberal groups running partisan get-out-the-vote operations. In fact, he helped those groups infiltrate election offices in key swing states by doling out large grants to crucial districts. That funding was the means by which Podhorzer and other activists achieved their revolution and changed the course of the 2020 election. The Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, an organization led by Zuckerberg's wife, Priscilla, gave more than $400 million to nonprofit groups that were part of the conspiracy to control the 2020 election. Most of those funds, colloquially called Zuck Bucks, were funneled through the Center for Tech and Civic Life, CTCL, a group led by three Democrats with a long history of activism. The couple also heavily funded the Center for Election Innovation and Research, a group run by a man who used to be the senior attorney at the left-wing People for the American Way. That group also funneled Zuck Bucks to governmental entities. Shortly before the election, David Plouffe, who is best known for running President Barack Obama's successful 2008 presidential campaign, published a book that said the 2020 election may come down to block-by-block street fights in Detroit, Philadelphia, and Milwaukee. Since 2017, he had been doing policy and advocacy work for the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. He was advising the group when it decided to give so much money toward privatizing and controlling the nation's election system in 2020. Plouffe, one of the Democratic Party's most successful campaigners, innately understood exactly what needed to happen for a lackluster Biden campaign to pull off a victory. He was part of the organization that gave millions of dollars to state and local governments, paving the way for liberal activists to gain entry into election offices in important state battlegrounds. CTCL is another voter outreach organization that, though technically nonpartisan, boasts strong ties to the Democratic Party. One of its founders is Tiana Epps Johnson, a former Obama Foundation fellow, who previously worked on the Voting Rights Project for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, a politically liberal advocacy group funded by progressive powerhouse foundations such as George Soros's Open Society Foundations. Epps Johnson founded CTCL with Whitney May and Donnie Bridges. All three worked on activism relating to election rules until 2015 for the New Organizing Institute, NOI, which the Washington Post described as the Democratic Party's Hogwarts for digital wizardry. Some on the right had called the influential Democratic training organization the left's new Death Star. NOI disbanded shortly after eight senior staff, including the trio that formed CTCL, walked out over frustration with how it was being managed in 2015. The $350 million from Zuckerberg would turn the relatively new and narrowly focused CTCL into a power player in the 2020 election. In 2018, CTCL's budget had been only $1.4 million. Now flush with cash, CTCL would disburse hundreds of millions of dollars in grants to election officials and local governments across the country. The private funding was billed publicly as COVID-19 response grants, ostensibly to help municipalities acquire protective gear for poll workers, or otherwise help prevent election officials and volunteers from contracting the virus. In practice, relatively little money was spent on measures to guard the health of election workers. Here, as in other cases, COVID-19 provided the cover to institute the left's political wish list. CTCL has been reluctant to share information about how its operation was run, but it did list the local governments it funded. Through open records requests, researchers have been able to piece together the massive effort to control the 2020 election. The money was purportedly given to counties regardless of their political leaning, but National Public Radio notes that not all grants were the same size. Some election officials and localities received small packets of CTCL funding, while others received enough grant money to fund their dream election. Democratic areas regularly received massively more funding than Republican counties, whether in terms of total dollar amount or per capita. When the Associated Press covered the effort in September 2020, it noted that conservatives were concerned about the Democratic origins of CTCL and that its donations have predominantly been in areas where Democrats depend on votes. The report claimed that the group intended to give some money to lower population Republican areas, but only after it had flushed piles of cash into Democratic areas throughout the summer. I don't think anybody would disagree that Philly would get substantially more money than some of these smaller counties, but proportionally, it appears to look as though some red counties were patted on the head and said, "Oh, here you go," to say that money went to red and blue counties combined. Representative Seth Grove, Republican, York County, told Broad and Liberty about the disparate funding in his state. The effect of the operation was monumental. According to the Foundation for Government Accountability, FGA, Georgia received more than $31 million in Zuck Bucks for the general election alone, one of the highest amounts in the country. It worked out to nearly 9% of all Zuckerberg funding, even though Georgia has just over 3% of the population of the country. The money was not spent on COVID-related issues. For instance, the three counties that received the most Zuck Buck funding spent only 1.3% of that funding on personal protective equipment. The rest was spent on salaries, laptops, vehicle rentals, attorneys' fees for public records requests, mail-in balloting, and other measures that allowed elections offices to hire activists to work the election. Not all 159 counties in Georgia received the funding. Of those that did, Trump-voting counties received an average of $1.91 per registered voter, while Biden-voting counties received, on average, $7.13 per voter. Put simply, Zuckerbucks counties in the Biden column were granted nearly four times as many Zuckerbucks per registered voter than were Zuckerbucks counties won by Trump, the FGA reported. They looked at it another way, too. Trump won Georgia by more than 5 points in 2016. He lost it by 0.3 percentage point in 2020. On average, as a share of the two-party vote, most counties moved Democratic by less than 1 percentage point in that time. Counties that didn't receive Zuck Bucks showed hardly any movement, but counties that were funded by Zuck Bucks moved, on average, 2.3 percentage points more Democratic. Likewise, in Georgia counties that did not receive Zuck Bucks, roughly half saw an increase in Democrat votes that offset the increase in Republican votes, while roughly half saw the opposite trend. But in counties that did receive Zuck Bucks, three-quarters of them saw a significant uptick in Democrat votes that offset any upward change in Republican votes, including the highly populated Fulton, Gwinnett, Cobb, and DeKalb counties. The Zuck Bucks kept flowing even after Election Day, as Georgia faced a runoff election to determine who its two senators would be. At least $14.5 million more in funding came in, with more than 60% allocated to the Democratic counties of Fulton and DeKalb alone. Yet again, Democrat districts were targeted, and Democrat votes were boosted, the FGA reported. Georgia's election results moved more than 5 points in the direction of the Democratic presidential candidate from 2016 to 2020, resulting not just in Trump's defeat, but the capture by Democrats of two key Senate races. Florida, by contrast, moved 2 points in Trump's direction in the same years. Even though Georgia's population is roughly half of Florida's population of 21.5 million people, it received many times the funding from left-wing groups. Of the more than $7 million given to Florida counties, the vast majority went to Democratic strongholds. More money could have swung Florida in a pro-Biden direction, analysis by the FGA suggested. A comparison of adjacent counties with historically similar voting patterns showed that Leon County, which received Zuck Bucks, saw an increase in Democratic voter turnout that more than offset the increase in Republican turnout. The neighboring Gadsden County, which received no Zuck Bucks, saw the opposite trend, an increase in Republican turnout that more than offset the increase in Democratic turnout. The same exact patterns were visible in several other pairs of contiguous counties, including Brevard and Volusia counties, Lake and Polk counties, and McCulloch and Liberty counties, indicating a trend of greater Democratic performance compared to 2016 in counties that received Zuckerbucks relative to their neighboring counties, the FGA reported. Democratic counties in Pennsylvania were also targeted for Zuckerbuck infusions. The Capital Research Center determined that Biden won 8 of the 10 highest-funded CTCL counties in the state, which together received $21,047,163, or more than 95% of all grants statewide. A Biden-winning county was over 3.5 times more likely to be funded by CTCL than a Trump-winning county. Trump counties received an average of 59 cents per capita, while Biden counties averaged $2.85 per capita. Philadelphia, the most richly funded Biden county, received $6.32 per capita, compared to a mere $1.12 for Berks, the most richly funded Trump county. Seasoned election observers went into November saying that Pennsylvania was a crucial swing state for the presidential election, and that Philadelphia would be ground zero for the Democratic candidates' hopes. CTCL partisans knew this too, and their investments in Pennsylvania show it, said Scott Walter, the president of the Capital Research Center. In Wisconsin, CTCL gave $6.3 million to the cities of Racine, Green Bay, Madison, Milwaukee, and Kenosha to ensure voting could be done in accordance with prevailing public health requirements to reduce the risk of exposure to coronavirus. Wisconsin law says voting is a right, but that voting absentee is a privilege. Voting by absentee ballot must be carefully regulated to prevent the potential for fraud or abuse, to prevent overzealous solicitation of absentee electors who may prefer not to participate in an election. It also says that elections are to be run by clerks or other government officials. The five cities of Wisconsin that received Zuck Bucks outsourced much of their election operation to private liberal groups. In one case, the private group's control was so extensive that a government official, frustrated at being sidelined by Zuckerberg-funded out-of-state activists, quit her job before the election. That was by design. Cities that received grants were not allowed to use the money to fund outside help unless CTCL specifically approved the plan in writing. CTCL kept tight control of how money was spent, and it had an abundance of partners to help with anything the cities needed. Some government officials were willing to do whatever CTCL recommended. As far as I'm concerned, I am taking all of my cues from CTCL and work with those you recommend. Celestine Jeffries, the chief of staff to Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich, wrote in an email, and CTCL had plenty of recommendations. The left-wing group CTCL said it had a network of current and former election administrations and election experts available to scale up your vote-by-mail processes and ensure forms, envelopes, and other materials are understood and completed correctly by voters. Each group was comprised of progressive activists who supported the Democratic Party, albeit from a posture of official nonpartisanship. Both Republicans and Democrats have such support groups and have for decades. Usually that's just politics, but not in 2020. CTCL's network groups offered services that would have a direct effect on election results. Power the Polls, a liberal group recruiting poll workers, promised to help with ballot curing. The liberal Mikvah Challenge worked to recruit high school age poll workers, and the left-wing Brennan Center could help with election integrity, including post-election audits and cybersecurity. The Center for Civic Design, an election administration policy organization, that frequently partners with left-of-center organizations such as liberal billionaire Pierre Omidyar's Democracy Fund, designed absentee ballots and voting instructions, often working directly with an election commission to develop a new envelope design and create an advertising and targeting campaign. The Elections Group, another group linked to the Democracy Fund, provided technical assistance in handling drop boxes and conducted voter outreach. The communications director for the Center for Secure and Modern Elections, a left-of-center advocacy organization, created to promote sweeping changes to the elections process, ran a conference call to help Green Bay develop Spanish language radio ads and geofencing to target voters in a predefined area. Digital Response, a nonprofit launched in 2020, offered to bring voters an updated elections website, run a website health check, set up communications channels, bring poll workers' application and management online, track and respond to polling location wait times, set up voter support and email response tools, bring vote-by-mail applications online, process incoming VBM applications, and help with ballot curing process tooling and voter notification. The amount of services Digital Response offered to officials was stunning. If your state does not provide online vote-by-mail applications, we can help you set one up, improving the application process for both you and your voters. We can help you set up tools to quickly notify voters with rejected ballots and then guide them through the ballot cure process. We'll help you monitor wait times at the polls, helping you respond where needed, and improving the voting experience. We'll help you set up the tools you need to share information with your voters across social, email, text, and web. The National Vote at Home Institute was presented as a technical assistance partner that could support outreach around absentee voting, provide and oversee voting machines, consult on methods to cure absentee ballots, and even take the duty of curing absentee ballots off of Green Bay's hands. A few weeks after the cities received their grant, CTCL emailed Claire Woodall-Vogg, the executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission, to offer an experienced election staffer that could potentially embed with your staff in Milwaukee in a matter of days. The staffer leading Wisconsin's portion of the National Vote at Home Institute was an out-of-state Democratic activist named Michael Spitzer Rubenstein. As soon as he met with Woodall-Vogg, he asked for contacts at the Wisconsin Election Commission and in the other cities. Spitzer Rubenstein would eventually take over much of Green Bay's election planning from the official charged with running the election, Green Bay City Clerk Chris Teske. Teske was not happy at being replaced by Spitzer Rubenstein and his team. A few weeks before the election, she would take Family and Medical Leave Act leave, quitting shortly thereafter. Emails from Spitzer Rubenstein show he was managing much of the election process. To one government official, he wrote, "By Monday, I'll have our edits on the absentee voting instructions. We're pushing QuickBase to get their system up and running, and I'll keep you updated. I'll revise the planning tool to accurately reflect the process. I'll create a flowchart for the vote-by-mail processing that we will be able to share with both inspectors and also observers." Once early voting started, Woodall-Vogg would provide him with a daily update on the numbers of absentee ballots returned and still outstanding in each ward. Prized information for a political operative. "Here's what I'll need," Spitzer Rubenstein wrote to her in late October. 1, number of ballot preparation teams. 2, number of returned ballots per ward. 3, number of outstanding ballots per ward. Amazingly, he even asked for direct access to the Milwaukee Election Commission's voter database. "We're hoping there's an easier way to get the data out of WisVote than you having to manually export it every day or week. To that end, we have 2 questions. 1, would you or someone else on your team be able to do a screen share so we can see the process for an export? 2, do you know if WisVote has an API or anything similar so that it can connect with other software apps? That would be the holy grail, but I'm not expecting it to be that easy." Even for Woodall-Vogg, who had been providing daily reports to the Democratic activist working for the nonprofit. That was too much. While I completely understand and appreciate the assistance that is trying to be provided, she wrote, I am definitely not comfortable having a non-staff member involved in the function of our voter database, much less recording it. When the emails were released in 2021, they stunned Wisconsin observers. What exactly was the National Vote at Home Institute doing with its daily reports? Was it making sure that people were actually voting from home by going door to door to collect ballots from voters who had not yet turned theirs in? Was this data sharing a condition of the CTCL grant? And who was really running Milwaukee's election? Asked Dan O'Donnell, whose election analysis appeared at Wisconsin's McIver Institute, a conservative think tank. The rigging of the election happened in front of our face, you know, said O'Donnell of what happened in Wisconsin. Wisconsin law stipulates elections are to be conducted by clerks, not by mayors or outside groups. Months before the election, Teske, an election clerk, wrote that she was being sidelined by the mayor's office and the outside funding. I haven't been in any discussions or emails as to what they are going to do with the money. I only know what has been on the news, in the media. Again, I feel I am being left out of the discussions and not listened to at the meetings, Teske wrote on July 9th. I just attended the ad hoc meeting on elections. I also asked when these people from the grant give us advisors, who is going to be determining if their advice is legal or not. I don't think it pays to talk to the mayor because he sides with Celestine Jeffries, so I know this is what he wants. I just don't know where the clerk's office fits in anymore, Teske wrote in early July. By August, she was worried about legal exposure. I don't understand how people who don't have the knowledge of the process can tell us how to manage the election, Teske wrote on August 28, 2020. She had good reason to worry. Even though state law clearly states that the city clerk is in charge of the election, Democratic Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich delegated that authority to agents from outside groups and gave them leadership roles in collecting absentee ballots, fixing ballots that would otherwise be voided for failure to follow the law, and even supervising the counting of ballots. The grant mentors would like to meet with you to discuss further the ballot curing process. Please let them know when you're available, Genrich's chief of staff, Celestine Jeffries, told Teske. Spitzer Rubenstein explained that the National Vote at Home Institute had done the same for other cities in Wisconsin. We have a process map that we've worked out with Milwaukee for their process. We can also adapt the letter we're sending out with rejected absentee ballots, along with a call script alerting voters. We can also get people to make the calls, too, so you don't need to worry about it. Emails show that Spitzer Rubenstein, a non-governmental official who was funded by the Democratic effort, had keys to the central counting facility and access to all the machines before election night. His name was on contracts with a hotel hosting the ballot counting. The city of Green Bay literally gave the keys to the election to a Democratic Party operative from New York, wrote M.D. Kittle, an investigative reporter. Sandy Juneau, who was clerk of Brown County, where Green Bay is located, testified about the problems in a legislative hearing after the fact. He was advising them on things. He was touching the ballots. He had access to see how the votes were counted, Juneau said of Spitzer Rubenstein. Others testified that he was giving orders to poll workers and seemed to be the person running the count operation on election night. I would really like to think that when we talk about security of elections, we're talking about more than just the security of the internet. You know, it has to be security of the physical location, where you're not giving a third party keys to where you have your election equipment, Juneau said. She noted that there were irregularities in the counting, too, with no consistency in how the various tables were processing ballots. Some even had absentee ballots face up, so anyone could see how they were marked. Juneau said poll workers were observed reviewing the ballot, not just to see that they'd been appropriately checked by the clerk, but reviewing how they were marked. And when poll workers were fixing ballots, they used the same color pens as the ones ballots had been filled out in, contrary to established procedures designed to make sure observers could differentiate between a voter's marks and a poll worker's mark. After the election, concerned citizens raised the alarm. A complaint was filed with the Wisconsin Election Commission, but it was dismissed. Megan Wolf, the administrator of the Wisconsin Election Commission, said the commission doesn't have any sort of statutory authority over private grant funding, and so the complaint was dismissed. The plan by Democratic strategists to bring their activist groups into the election offices worked, in part, because no legislature had ever imagined that a nonprofit could take over so many election offices so quickly and so easily. If it can happen to Green Bay, Wisconsin, sweet little old Green Bay, Wisconsin, these people can coordinate any place, said Janelle Brentjen, a state representative in Wisconsin. Democrats were willing to take extreme measures to keep the privatized funding that enabled their political activists to embed in the election system. After the Wisconsin legislature passed a bill banning private funding of election operations by a 60-36 margin in the state assembly and by an 18-14 margin in the state senate, Governor Tony Evers vetoed the ban. Without tech oligarchs buying the administration of the state's elections, Democrats stand to lose. What happened in Green Bay by means of the large grant from Zuckerberg also happened in countless Democrat-run cities across the country. Cities and counties took money from the left-wing Center for Tech and Civic Life to help with elections. The strings attached to the money required officials to work with partner organizations to massively expand mail-in voting and staff their operation with activists. These partner organizations were all left-wing groups that then ran a Democratic get-out-the-vote operation through the election offices themselves. It was a genius plan. And because no one ever imagined that a coordinated operation could pull off the privatization of the election system, laws were not built to combat it. In fact, nobody even really figured it out until Ball's article and the emails in Green Bay came to light months after the fact. Big tech got meaner, bigger, stronger, and they were crazed, Trump says, reflecting on their election meddling by means of censorship and algorithms. And as for the rigging by means of interference of liberal activists in administering elections, Trump is even more blunt. Zuckerberg should be in jail, he says.